Blog Talk Radio.
Sun goes down in the Northeast on a Sunday night. Three gentlemen get together and share provocative talk. We'll explore the male perspective on love, life, and relationships. And we leave you for honest self-evaluation. I think most of the time we come very close. Sometimes I think we exceed. But one thing we're not going to do, we're not going to shower some things that need to be said. But all together, we are. When Black Men Talk, thank you for giving us a listen. We're on Spotify, Google Podcasts. We just got added to Amazon Podcasts as well. And, of course, we're still kicking from time to time on Facebook. I'm Mark Elliott, soon to be joined by Mr. DeBreece and Mr. Charles. Tonight's going to be a little different from maybe what we normally do, and maybe not. But we're going to kick back a little later on and take a look at the black male life, in a sense. How delicate it is, almost a rare commodity. As I spoke earlier, it's three of us, so I won't be doing all the talking. We're going to bring one more gentleman that's going to be helping out. It's the cat that came to me several years ago and said, I want you to do something. I don't know what it is, but just do something. That's how you talk sometimes, you know. Maybe not in those exact words, but that's how he gives it to you. I don't know what I want you to do, but just do it. He's a cousin. He's a strong fabric of what we do here. He's Mr. DeBreece. How you feeling, cousin?
I appreciate you. I'm feeling great, man. It's 80 degrees in Chicago. I'm out hitting the town and took a shower, took a nap. I'm good, bro.
It's amazing, man. The weather here is funny. I think we hit like 75, 76 in Connecticut today. Yesterday, you could have thermals on yesterday, bro. That is no exaggeration. You could have thermals on and today.
Wow.
Yeah. Radical change, man, less than 24 hours. So, as you know, we're moved into May, and think about it, man. We're 5 months into 2021. Think about a year ago with everything that was going on with the COVID, and, you know, people were fasting, and there's a lot of stuff that, a lot of uncertainty. But when we stop and think about it, man, things are starting to kind of clear out. More than that, bro, we're still standing, man. We're still standing. We're still doing what we do. Something to be thankful for. Absolutely, bro. I'm gonna take us back about 57 years ago, man. 57 years ago, before Kaepernick refused to basically not stand, there was a track field star. Her name was Arona Sina Rose Robinson. Now, back in 1959, at the Pan American Games, this young lady, when the Star Spangled Banner was played, decided not to stand. Now, she wasn't at the time protesting what Kaepernick was protesting. She was protesting the government's foreign policies. But I want to go back there and think about this for a second, because if you look at, and I've said this on numerous times, some of the cats now that will basically stand for the national anthem or whatever, in sports, I'm speaking of in general. But one thing I will say, I noticed this the other night. And these guys aren't players, but these are just participants that came to the NFL draft. But I want to make this point first. A lot of players basically refused when Kaepernick was taking a knee to join him. And for my part of thinking, point of thinking, I think it was a lot of selfish reasons. But jump back to the NFL draft that took place Thursday. And if you notice when they were playing, every time they played a national anthem, I turned my TV down for the most part. I knew they'd turn it down or I leave the room and do both. As I sat and watched, man, one thing I noticed, there was a lot of black folks. They might have been standing, but their hands weren't on their chest. And you can kind of tell they weren't feeling it. They weren't not into the all-American kumbaya type of thing. And I know you and I haven't stand for that song probably ever in that sense. But it was kind of interesting to see and happy to see that some folks are waking up and realizing what's really behind that song. First, I want to jump on her what Ms. Robinson did back in 1959, get your opinion, and then move up to 2021 last Thursday. And I don't know if you caught that or not, where some folks now are saying, you know, I'll stand or maybe I'll not stand, but if I do stand, I'll be damned if I put my hand on my heart. Your response, sir?
Well, that's why I love you and Charles, because sometimes I miss some of those history facts, and you two will bring it out and educate me. So I didn't know about that, but I do appreciate that, sister, because that was a much rougher time than now to be taking a stance like that, and she was able to come out and do that and had the courage to do that. So, and I'm just amazed that we hadn't heard about her or nobody really talked about her and the sacrifice she made. But what the other thing I noticed about the draft, man, is they I believe they played the Negro National Anthem. They were nice. They had some students up there singing it, and that was a little bit different because when I heard it, I was in the other room because it didn't start yet. And I figured they were going to do something like that. When I heard it, I'm like, okay, they're singing the Negro National Anthem. Okay, that's great. That's great. And so I think it's their way of really kind of trying to show a more pro-African American face in the NFL. Like, we care. We've heard your stories. We've heard what you've been trying to tell us, and we're trying to slowly but surely incorporate that into our fabric, because you're 75% to 80% of our league. But I really hadn't noticed anything else other than that. You always notice the black players that are getting, you know, selected and their families and things of that sort. And I know we were on the air when it was happening, and we were making comments about, you know, some of the families and how they were showing out with their loved one being chosen. But I didn't notice that. I didn't notice that. But the only thing I did notice was the Black National Anthem.
That's nice they played it, man. I didn't even notice they played that. But I will say this, man. When I think about Kaepernick taking the stand and, you know, to ruffle a lot of feathers, and he needed to do so, but think about this in a sense, NFL, the power of NFL carries. Not that it's, you know, unique to us in knowing this, but it's Thursday night at 8 o'clock, man. Thursday night, not a game, not a football game, a draft. They have 30 million people tuning in, bro.
Yeah.
30 million people tune in to watch a long, sometimes boring draft. That says a lot, man. So if they're changing their ways, which I believe they have, since Colin Kaepernick picked me and they got on board and doing some positive things, I applaud them, because that's a lot of power, bro. That's a lot of power, a lot of influence, and we can use it. I want to wish this young man a happy birthday. We had a virtual cake with a candle on it. We would pass it to him. Mr. Charles is turning a year older, a year wiser. Doesn't mean anything when it comes down to him and I battling the sports. I'm still going to beat you, bro. Happy birthday.
Was there an echo on here or something? Was there an echo? Ain't nobody, as my one of my great relatives would have said back in the day, ain't nobody studying you, Mr. Mark.
I never knew what that meant, man. I should have a I should date a woman years, which is saying it to her from time to time. I never knew what that meant. Studying me. What the heck that means? Somebody gotta fool me up with that. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, anybody studying you, Mr. Mark. So that means basically, Mr. Mark, no one is paying you attention, sir, for those that are on a different level with phonetics and things of that nature and articulating their articulators that are, and when necessary. So, yeah, appreciate it.
You're welcome, man. You're welcome. Tonight's going to be a little different, gentlemen, as I stated earlier. I mean, a lot of times you spend time on love and relationships, and that's cool. We'll come back to that next week. Next week I'm going to toss up a little bit, and we might have talked about this a while ago. I think, strangely enough, sometimes when we're choosing the mate to be with or really looking for a potential mate, I think sometimes we're looking for qualities that our mother possessed. So we'll spend a little time dancing around with that on the next show. And we might spend a little time with going back into forgiveness some and kind of open the door on that a little bit more. But tonight is basically around the black male life. And it's sad in a sense because I came across some stalling numbers that from last year. And if I had to guess, I don't think they're that better this year. And it kind of just blew me away. And some of it didn't surprise me to an extent, but – yeah, to read it and realize that the numbers that I was reading really kind of translate into human lives, man. That's what kind of, even though it may not surprise you, that's kind of when it really punches you in the chest. And the amazing numbers are here. Black men and black boys make up 2% of the nation's population. Let me say that again. Black men and boys make up 2% of the nation's population. But 30% of the gun homicides happen to black men and boys. Think about that for a second. 37% of the gun homicides are pointed and dealt with black men and black boys. Young black men and boys are killing each other at a rate of 20 times more than white males at the same ages. 20 times more. So when you hear those numbers kind of jump out, and I said last week, it was a guy on television, Wiley, sports commentator, and he was speaking of how roughly in a year there's 7,500 deaths due to black people killing other black people. And when you calculate how many police officers killing black people, 250. Not that 250 is not a big number for us for them taking our lives, but when you look at the rate that we're taking each other's lives, it has to kind of ring a bell somewhere. So I'm going to come to you first, Mr. Charles. When you hear the numbers of how we make up 2% of the population, at the same time, we're dying by homicide, 37%. How does that resonate with you, sir?
Well, one is sad. It's startling. It's sad to hear that because it hurts my heart, standpoint, because my question is to myself, why? And I don't know if I'll never get that answer, but why? But my thing is, do we hate each other that much, or when, particularly when it's in our hands, that we hate each other that much that we are just, we will prefer to kill one another when we have issues and arguments or whatever it may be. So it's staggering, particularly when you mention about the percentages, the overall percentage. And there's not a lot of us, that tells you there's not a lot of us here in regards to the population. And the younger people think it just hurts my heart because there's some things are going to happen naturally. I get that because people are going to be people. But there's a disconnect somewhere. There's a disconnect, and I'm trying to say we can't save everybody, but there has to be a way to try to send some of that off and figure some of this out to kind of reduce that number.
Yeah. We're going to a little later what each of us feel might be behind it. But, yeah, man, when you think about it, those numbers jump out and grab you. And I'm going to, throw this out later. I'll say it now, then that will respond to it. But, no one says this. When you realize that we're not that much part of the population at whole and the way we're dying, it's a possibility. This is a very strong possibility that black male can become extinct. They talk about animals, a polar bear or whatever, becoming extinct. We keep going at the rate where we're headed. Think about that for a second. Maybe not in the next 5 years, but years beyond. You can look around, you're not going to really see any of us. Mr. Demetrius, want to bring you in and get your response to some of the numbers that were read, sir?
Yeah, it's alarming, and it's been that way for a long time. And we qualify to be on that list. We qualify, if you look at the list of endangered species and why they put some species on that list, black men qualify to be on the endangered species list. And I believe D.L. Hughley did a documentary maybe about 5, 6, 7 years ago about going up to Congress and getting a petition signed to put black males on the endangered species list. Because if we're not in jail, if we're not, in the lifestyle to go to jail, we're really kind of non-existent in this society, and we keep doing it to each other. And it's sad, I haven't looked at the numbers in a while, but it's sad to hear the numbers that are coming out that we're doing it to ourselves. There are other things that can take us out, But when you do it to yourself, man, it doesn't make sense.
I remember hearing this said years ago. And when I first heard it, I wanted to get mad. And this was going back maybe 15, 20 years ago. And they caught up with an ex-Klansman. And he said, black people are killing more black people than we ever did. And when I, read it, and the first thing I was like, who is this mother to say anything like this? But then sometimes a fact is a fact. And I don't want to equate the numbers, whatever, but when something can be said that is that startling, it might be true, how the hell do you kind of look around it? I don't care who's saying it. I mean, I really don't at that point. And what I wonder sometimes, it's been going on for a while. It's nothing new. It's been going on. But there has to be something, some type of hate, some level of hate, disrespect, honor, or something, when you can look at someone that resembles you and you know of your life struggles, you know of your family struggles, you know of your ancestors' struggles, and there's a disconnect to where you really just want to do away with that person. There's something deep that resides, real deep. And I know there's different factors to it. We might touch on a few a little bit later, but to me, that's what it is, man. I don't know how. I mean, I can be mad as I want to be, and I guess I grew up at a time when we basically fought. But me actually taking a gun to take another black man's life would be the last thing on my mind. Now, I may rough him up, I may fight or whatever, but to actually think and have that inside of me, what would drive me to want to kill another black man? I mean, and I just wanted us to think about that for a second. What would drive you to it? What would kind of put you in the driver's seat of anger? What would be your motivation? Where would the malice come from? To where you basically, at that point where you can grab a weapon and fire like crazy and kill another black man and not think twice about it and probably feel damn good about it. Puff your chest out, walk around like you accomplished something. That's the mentality that I just can't connect with. But I'm going to come back to this one with you, Ms. DeMaurice, because to me, and this, I felt this way for a while. Like, who cares? Who really cares? Because what I've noticed when we kill each other, it's almost, we're almost immune to it in a sense. For a second we look at it and we'll say something and we kind of try to figure out, and then we're beyond it. It's like it's no big deal. It has gotten to happen. It has happened. It's been happening so rapidly over the years to where sometimes we don't even flinch when we're paying attention to it. We just feel like there's a certain segment of our community, that's what they're doing, and we look the other way. But the truth and reality of the matter is when we stop and think about it, who cares who's doing this?
Well, if you look at society, society doesn't care, and it's taught us, I think, very young, we learn how to hate each other because society doesn't care about us. And then if we're out with each other, society doesn't care, then why should I care about you? Why should I care about your life? Why should I care whether you exist? As long as I am here, I don't care about what you do. But it reminds me of a Carter Godwin Woodson quote from The Miseducation of the Negro. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read it because when I thought about
take
it,
your time, bro. Take your time.
And he said, if you can control a man's thinking, you don't have to worry about his action. When you determine what a man shall think, you do not have to be concerned or concern yourself about what he will do. If you make a man feel that he is inferior, you do not have to compel him to accept an inferior status, for he will seek it out himself. If you make a man think that he is justly an outcast, You do not have to order him to the back door. He will, without being told, and if there is no back door, he will, in his nature, will demand one. So that kind of is a microcosm of if you control the thinking, and we get indoctrinated into hating ourselves through watching TV, or how society treats us, how we're treated, whether it's educational, so all walks of life. We see it all the time, playing out in movies, television, things of that sort. So you get indoctrinated with that. No, you don't care, because why should you? Because it doesn't mean anything. When you have, people just killing you just because and getting away with it, then it gives you a sense that your life doesn't mean anything. So if you're face-to-face with a situation where it's his life or mine, you don't think twice sometimes. I mean, that's the mentality that's out there. And it's a sad mentality to have, but we've been indoctrinated with this from the beginning. And we're all our own worst enemy at times, because we haven't woken up as black men to realize that folks don't care if we take each other out. And we got to wake up and figure out why they don't care. Because it used to be them coming after us. Now it's us coming after us. And what kind of mindset do you have to be, or that you were put in, to get to that point where you take out somebody that looks just like you?
I saw a picture today, and the picture was 35 years old. It was an older lady holding it. And it seemed like she was at a protest, but it wasn't a lot of people. And she was holding, like, a sign, and she was holding it from the top. And it just had three words: stop police killing. 55 years ago. Stop police killing. You touched on a lot of good points there, Mr. DeMaurice, and it's true. Because, you know, one thing that, as a race of people, and I'm not just going to put this as a sole factor, but we have spent too much time watching television. And we have always been portrayed on TV. I've shared this before in this show, where I read this several years ago. The average black American watches TV 7-8 hours a day. You're watching TV. So you have to believe, if you're doing anything, if your mind is focused on anything for that period of time, throughout the course of a day, it's changing the way you feel, the way you think. And I know some folks, man, I know you too probably know them too, they can't wait to get to the news, bro. They can't wait for the news to come on. They want to see if they know the way they died, do whatever. They just can't wait. And the news may have gotten a little better over the years, not much. But when it comes to reporting us, they kind of report us always with a slant. You could have crime going on in a white neighborhood, you would never know. They won't even talk about it. You know, you got to have somebody basically shoot 20 or 30 people or take their family off. And if they do, they hide their names, they don't show anything. They report it much differently. And that's been going on for the longest period of time. So if you're sitting there absorbing 7-8 hours of this, not only just the news, just shows, where basically a lot of shows we watch or grew up watching or seeing, movies or whatever, who's the first to die? We know the running joke in horror movies. The black people are the first to die. Ain't nothing new. Remember Steven Seagal did a movie years ago. Now, this guy was one of the worst actors in probably movie history. But he was smart to realize, in order to get asses in the seat, I'm going to use a lot of different weapons. So he did one movie. He said, all right. But black people wanted to go see it. And guess who he was killing in the movie? Just take a wild guess. I won't even answer. Well, his next movie came out. Barely could speak good English. His next movie came out. The trailers came out. Please. That movie was number one for several weeks. had all different types of Uzis in there, shooting up black folks left and right. Who do you think paid to go watch themselves be shot? Mr. Charles, who cares?
Sorry about that, bro. We care, man.
That's all right, bro.
No, I'm here. We care, man. We care. Now, the stats don't show that, but if we didn't care, we wouldn't be here, bro. As much as I buy into those numbers and I know them to be true, I also know how hard it is for us to be where we're at. The fact that you're having this show right now, bro, and we're here, there's still light, man. We've always been facing things where it seems like there's no future in sight or no way to reconcile or have anything positive to think about. So society hasn't cared for a long time, and they don't care because they showed us that even as recent as George Floyd. Certain people think that they can do what the hell they want to us, and oftentimes they do and get away with it. But to give up and not keep striving forward is still not an option because there are still some of us to follow, some of our young men to follow. And the sadness of the violence of killing one another, I just see to it where, and I know this personally because I've seen situations or been around situations enough how people think and why they will pull a trigger. It doesn't make sense to the average man or the man that is going somewhere or the man that has a positive outlook on life or energy. But when you think about it, you mentioned about the twisted way of thinking and how way our young people's minds have been maneuvered and manipulated from the standpoint that material things are so important that they would kill to keep the material things that they have accomplished or the material things that they have achieved or grabbed or earned or whatever you want to do or taken. They would kill for those things. That's the sad point. There are many out there like that because that's all that they know. The only thing they have, they don't have perhaps the education, the life experience, whatever it may be, even the work experience to gravitate or even the love of their family to hold on to that keeps them going. But all they have is materialistic things. It can be money. It can be cars, whatever it may be. Those things mean something to them. So much so that if you try to take mine, even to the point of my woman, you try to take that from me, I will kill you where you stand. That's real talk.
I wonder sometimes, like when someone does a murder, based on what you just said, Mr. Charles, over a woman, we know there's plenty of men in jail for killing over a woman, bro. Let's be honest. We know that. I mean, fighting and killing, and there's no woman on the face of this earth worth going to jail for. There ain't no woman on this face of earth worth killing for. None. Maybe your mother. Outside of that, there is none, bro. And, I mean, I hear all that. But what I was going to say is that I wonder when you take a life, you really hurt, you take a life, what do you feel shortly thereafter? What do you feel? Because at some point, the adrenaline has to leave you. That anger, it dies, it comes down. And what are you thinking at that point? What are you feeling? Because what do I want to believe that your conscience at some point has to come knock on your door, has to knock on your mental door. That, I'm wondering how that's dealt with. How does that manifest itself? How is that treated? And to me, you have to, when that happens, you have to put on the front and act like you don't care. But the thing about your conscience, it doesn't care. It keeps coming back. It doesn't leave you. Keeps coming back over and over and over again. And I, you know, we're going to get into the factors a little bit, but the materialistic stuff, I don't know. But I do want to touch base on this before we move on. And I wonder, especially when it comes to black males, it almost seems like black males give up on education very early. Some of us, a good portion of us. And we can go back to when we were in school, but I'll fast forward it now. But it seemed like black males, for whatever reason, we don't tend to link in into education. And if I was to put that question to you, Mr. Charles, is there a reason behind that?
Yes, there is. And I'll say that from my personal experience, and I think it goes a long way from other people as well. Because of the fact that many of us are never taught that is actually an option. That's not for us. As you mentioned, the messages that we receive, the messages are, those are for so-called smart people. That's not us. If I live a certain way or if I live under a tough situation as far as poverty is concerned, that's not an option for me. Or you have a counselor like my counselor in high school told me that I should go to a trade school. I wasn't smart enough. So when you don't have any positive markers or people telling you that there's an option or a way to go receive that education, it's a lot different now because people go online and maybe certain ones can receive it. But back then, and it might be true today, oftentimes if your parents or somebody else does not have that experience and you're living a certain kind of way and nobody's promoting you or helping you to, that no one's nurturing you or helping you to move forward in life with a positive attitude, you're not going to receive that message. And thank God, my dad, even though he had a 10th grade education, but he was well-read. He was a scholar from the standpoint of the way he read. He told me there was no way in hell I wasn't going to college. If he had to take me up to the school and put me at gunpoint, I was enrolling for a day or two or something. Because he knew that was the wave of the future for me. That was my opportunity because I wasn't great with my hands. I probably could have learned a skill, but he knew that was the future. That's how I could excel in life. But I think, again, getting back to the point, many of us are not exposed to it. And when we are exposed to the point of furthering your education, it's not a pleasant experience because they look at you face value. What's your GPA? Where you come from? How you test? How do you talk? How you dress? There's a lot of things going on. And sometimes you have to get to the core of a young person and understand that there are late bloomers. There are many late bloomers out there waiting for somebody to untap that potential for them. But if they don't receive the correct information or the correct guidance, you'll never see them. They'll go off and who knows what's going to happen to them.
You know, when you were saying about your father's education, you know, same thing my parents and my mother, basically my father, grandfather, and my mother stopped out of school early to work on the farm. She might have got as far as fifth or sixth grade when I think about it. And my father, kind of like the same story for the most part, the family. But the difference back then was, even though they stopped, they valued education. It's just like your father did. And they wanted to make sure the mentality of the generation back then, they valued it. They wanted to make sure that the kids were at a certain level of it because they knew what it meant to how it was going to place you in the world. But when I look at our young black males, I don't see that anymore, Mr. DeMaurice. I just don't see it. I don't see it to where there's a focus on them to get education. And even if you look at the numbers of black males going to college a few years ago as opposed to the black females, it always seemed like, you know, the black males weren't kind of leveling up in that sense with the numbers. And I noticed here in Connecticut, and it's not talked about much, that the dropout rate is huge. And I think the kids can drop out after 15 or 16. They can just drop out, and there's nothing to be done about it. So a lot of our young males are dropping out, you know, at an early stage and don't have that vision of education, what it can do for you. And partly because they get lost in looking at other things, rap stars, in a sense, that's kind of, for a lot of them, they think that's an easy way to get where they need to be. They look at sports stars, they think that's an easy way. But one thing that our parents back then, even beyond education, you was going to work and work hard at something. There was something that you was going to do and you was going to be working hard at doing it. You just weren't going to be able to kind of basically think life was going to come to you easy and you don't work hard at it. But coming to you with this one, Mrs. Reese, about us in education, the younger black male, it doesn't seem like our vision and our focus has been there for a long period of time.
No, and I think I said on the show a while ago, I said a few things. Well, I'll start it this way. The first person that put it in my mind that I was going to school was my father. And I'm very young. You're going to go to college. Never knew why, but he just kept putting that in my brain. But as I was going through school, I didn't see the value of having an education versus the reality I was seeing what was happening to black folks in my neighborhood and where I lived and things like that. So I didn't see it. And I think I mentioned on the show also that I was on the verge of quitting. And you two didn't know about this, but I was on the verge of quitting high school. And it was my mother sitting at my bed every morning giving me a tinfoil sandwich, a sandwich in tinfoil, hot breakfast every morning, saying, I know how you feel, but just keep going. Just keep going. Some good things are going to come out of this. Keep going. If it wasn't for her, and then I'm going to mention two other women that were in my high school, Ms. Pollinus, who was my history teacher, who saw me as, you know, saw me being a knucklehead in school and like, listen, sat me down, like, listen, you got a chance to go to school and do some good things and do some great things. So I know you want to have fun with your classmates and all this other stuff. I know you probably don't see the value of this, but you got a good head on your shoulders and you need to really consider going. She said that in my junior year. And then Ms. Carberry, who was my English teacher, but also became the principal of Hill House High School at one particular time. And I really didn't take it seriously. This is kind of a funny story. I really didn't take it seriously until I was in Ms. Carberry's class. And we had to do a 10-page essay for our final paper in English class on the comparisons and contrasts of Shakespeare's plays. And I procrastinated, bro. I procrastinated to the night before. And I went to the library, just grabbed a bunch of books, went home, stayed up all night, wrote that 10-page paper, handwritten. Turned it in, didn't think nothing of it. As long as I turned something in, got a grade, I can get out of high school. That's all I was thinking, man. So her thing was she was going to give the prize to the best paper that she got of all the classes. It was like 27 of us in there. I'm in the back with Eric, my boy Eric Gomez. We in the back playing around like we usually do in class, ain't paying attention. And she was announcing who won. And she said the winner of this final paper is Don Waddell. And I looked around like, what? Who? What did I do? I thought she'd call me out for doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And all my boys kept laughing. They start laughing at me like, ah. So one of the things is I didn't see the value of education. One of the reasons why I see the value of education is because once you become educated, you really learn when you go to college. You get ridiculed and rejected for going to school, trying to better yourself, because now you're using another you're using the King's English properly. You're learning different things. You're coming back to the people that you grew up with. You're like, oh, man, you're trying to be white. Look at the professor here, this, that, the other. And so that kind of gets on you too. But when I won the prize was I went out to dinner with Ms. Carberry. She picked me up at Grandma's house. She wanted to meet my grandmother. I told her about my grandmother. And Grandma was so proud. the stuff that she was telling Grandma about me and all this other stuff, I didn't know this woman was watching me this closely. And we went out to dinner, and it was a serious talk about life and what you need to do next, because you got some talent. You got talent, and don't waste your talent out here in these streets or being silly. Go to school, do what you got to do. And that thing stuck in my head. And when I graduated, me, Eric, and Scott, my boys, they stayed over at Grandma's house, me and Grandma's house. The day after graduation, I woke up, and you realize after high school, you go, damn, what am I going to do now? Because I don't have no job. I ain't got nowhere to go. There ain't no school to go to the next day. So what am I going to do? So there was an application at Wilberforce University that I had just been putting off. And I remember filling it out that day and sending it in, saying, okay, I can still register. I still got time. And them calling me maybe a month and a half later, saying, you know, and sending a letter saying they're accepting. But you don't get that value, man. And a lot of these cats see the same thing I see. And so when I see cats that are African-American now coming through college, when I see them, man, I can't tell you how many times over the 16 years I've been in that school where a brother has come to me and said, man, if it wasn't for you, I'd have quit a long time ago. Because they didn't see the value. They felt the same, and they were going through some of the same things I was going through. Nobody encouraging them. Nobody pulling them to the side like, listen, man, let me share with you the talent I see in you. We don't get that, man. We get ridiculed. We get hated on. We get chastised. We get laughed at for trying to do better. It's like, crabs in a bucket kind of syndrome. Like, you trying to get up higher? No, we're gonna pull you down. And so that's really kind of a tough opponent to go against, you know, all that trying to better yourself, and you don't see the reward right in front of you. It's not like you finish this is what you get. No, you finish this, and it's still no certainty that you will get, you know, the things that you want, but you got to get to that point to see what's over that hill, over that, you know, beyond that rainbow that you get to, or that reward. So I didn't see the value, man. And I'm not by myself. I went to college with a lot of cats that felt the same way. No option. But, you know, made a leap of faith and said, you know, I'm going to come here. I'm going to try it out. And maybe I'll get, you know, something better than I see back home. Because we were all coming from different places. We were all coming from and staying somewhere that, you know, we were calling our home on campus. But it was a lot of uncertainty. And then we had to go to a school where they nurtured our gifts and our talents. They nurtured that. That's why I always suggest that black kids, historically black colleges, because you're going to get nurtured in ways that you're not going to get nurtured everywhere else. You know, you may not run into people in them big colleges that are going to pull you to the side and really kind of talk to you and give you what you need to hear. Not what you want to hear, but what you need to hear. You're not going to run up against Dr. Jane Ball. That's not going to let you just get by, but you have to be elite to do what you need to do in this world. And I'm going to prepare you for that. So we don't get nurtured. We get rejected. We get attacked for trying to get higher education. We get pushed off. We get laughed at. And, you know, as a young black male, you want to be part of the group. You want to be accepted because you've been rejected by everything that society has to offer. So you don't want to be rejected by your own. So sometimes we fall to the peer pressure and go, yeah, that wasn't so important anyway. You know, what y'all drinking on tonight? What we doing tonight? And a lot of guys fall, you know, through the cracks like that. And I understand that. I really understand that. But I was fortunate enough to have people in my life to say, you know, keep going. Keep going. This is valuable. This is going to work out. I know you don't see it, but just keep pushing and grinding, and you will get where you want to go.
I love the fact we do what we do. I really do, man. We you all bring different things to the conversation, and that's probably the best thing that we do here. So we all bring on different perspectives. And that's what it is. That's what Black Men Talk. I love that we have the dialogue. We're not afraid to share But I'm going to toss this out in a second because I said earlier there's some factors behind it. I mean, you know, it's a lot of different factors, so I'm not going to throw this out as being the main key factor. But I think it's a factor that should be discussed because I think the role of the black father plays a role. And I'm going to give an example of what you spoke of, Mr. DeMaurice, when you was in class and laughing and joking. And my son, a little younger than, I think probably at the time, you spoke of when he was in junior. He was a junior. My son was younger. He probably was in his sixth grade at this time. And he was doing very well in school. But one morning, at the time I was working overnights. So I get a call. Wasn't home that long. Got in bed, slept a little bit, get a call. And the school had called his mother. He was acting up in school, clowning with some other boys. So mother called me and said, we'll talk with him when he comes home. Nah, that ain't working. No, not for a child of mine. That ain't working. So, you know, jumped up, went to school. And I always remember, I can't think of her name, but at the front desk, this white lady worked there. Always been nice, always been pleasant. So I said, you find out what class my son is in? And I said, have him come down. I want to speak with him. He said, okay. So he comes down, and he was shocked when he came to the office. I was there. I don't think they told him I was there, but they just sent him to the office. So we had to buzz to get in. There was like a hallway once you buzz to get in before you come in. So brought him outside the hallway. And I could see when I was bringing him out, she looked, and if she saw me kind of look back, she kind of put her head down. She didn't say anything. She walked out, and I just basically talked to him. I'm not going to say it was all nice, but I said that, you know, you're at the school for a reason, something to get. And I don't care what the other kids do. I don't care if they're laughing, they're joking, whatever. You can't do that. You got to focus on what you're trying to get. Don't allow them to get in your way of what you're trying to achieve. You know, I don't clothe you and feed you to come here to be a clown. I clothe and feed you to come here to get an education. And, you know, we had that conversation. He walked off. And it was something he needed. And I'm not saying he was perfect. I'm not saying he never laughed or whatever, but he needed to hear that at that particular moment. That, you know, I've been in school. We've all been in school. You laugh and joke, whatever, but you can't pay attention to what's going on if you're clowning. If you're clowning, and it's easy to be a clown. And another thing I said to him, some of these people you see laughing, joking, they're not going where you're trying to go. You may never know where you're trying to go now, but they're not trying to go there. Understand that. And that is the reality of it. But I think fathers, and, you know, there's factors behind that, but absentee fathers, bro. And then you got fathers there that don't know what to do. But I just don't understand. This is the thing that bothers me when it comes to when I see the killings going on, stuff of that nature. Because I remember years ago when I would hear stories, even if it wasn't, you know, a murder in that sense, or something, you know, a young male did something stupid, the first thing that hit my mind, I didn't even utter the words, where's his dad? Because to me, my seed can't be causing havoc in the community, bro. Just can't be happening without me coming to grab my seed in this column. It just, that's just who I am. You know, you're not going to be out here doing such. And every male that's been out here, that's been doing this, that's been shooting, and you make a very good point, Mr., because you're looking to be associated, and that's what happens in a lot of situations. Young males looking for someone to associate themselves with, to feel good about themselves, and they don't look beyond that. But my point is, realistically, these young men came from semen, bro. They came from a sexual act from a male. So if these males are out here and they're doing these things, where are their dads? Where are they? Because it takes any man to pump semen inside of a woman, bro. Any man can do that. You can start doing it at 13, 14 years of age. But where are they when these semen are turning into grown human beings? And out here doing this dumb shit, and you act like that's not your child. So I that's the stuff to me that always messed with my head, because I'm wondering how, how that is so easy to see and know your kid is out here doing this and you don't come back for him. I'm going to come to you first, Mr. DeMaurice. I mean, I'm not expecting you to give me a great answer, an answer that's going to please the masses. But to me, some of this, you touched on a little earlier about black men, but some of this lies right at our feet because they're not raising our boys. Because there's nowhere in the world, if I'm teaching my child to honor and respect other black men, he's going to be quick enough to kill another. It just doesn't happen. But if he sees me not having love and respect for another black male, disdain for a man that looks like me, well, I want to basically choke his fucking head off his body. What do you think he's going to feel? What is he going to feel? So I think some of this basically comes to our feet. We don't want to hear it. We don't want to digest that. We don't even want to accept it. But it is so. Because when you can't basically raise your child and man up to your own kid, what are you doing as a man, as a father? What are you doing? Here again, any man could pump semen in a pussy. It is what it is. Your response, Demarie.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to whether we're there as a single dad or married, to show our children how we conduct ourselves around other men. Even when my kids were younger, I took them around with me as far as with other men. So I have friends here, and, you know, I'm like, this is your Uncle Wayne, this is your Uncle Daryl, and they see you laughing and talking and really kind of breaking bread together and all this stuff, and they had children. And we brought the children together, things of that sort, to show them that this is how you conduct yourself. Even introducing them to your family. This is your grandfather. This is your uncle, your great uncle. These are your cousins. And seeing, you know, the family be around each other. And because, you know, for me, I knew I wanted to show them my side of the family because I knew they would get some good examples of how men treat each other, laugh, talk, hug, and just are being around each other, encouraging each other. Didn't know what they were getting on the other side because they're kind of a close-knit family, and they just don't kind of expand and go to the relatives too much. It's pretty much, limited with that. And I remember having a conversation with my daughter maybe about a couple of years ago. We were having dinner, and we were talking about, you know, when I used to come and pick them up, you know, every other weekend, things of that sort. And she was like, well, yeah, I always missed you those times. Did you ever wonder about us and all this stuff? I said, sweetheart, I had eyes on you all the time. She was like blown away. I was like, I had eyes on you all the time. So I knew sometimes where you were, and you didn't even know I was around. I had friends. When I'm telling you about your Uncle Ivan and your Uncle Daryl, and all, friends that were around, making sure you all were okay. When your brother got his hand, he was trying to open up a can of whatever to cook on the stove. I said, the first call wasn't from your mother. It was from my boy, one of the guys you met, my boy Isaac, who worked at the hospital, and said, hey, man, you're going to need to come in here and check your son. Need to check your son. Your son just got, you know, here, and the mom is here. Then while I was on my way there, almost at the front door, that's when the mother called me. And my boy right then and there told me, listen, we can take the kids right now if you want me to, because he worked at the hospital in DCFS. We can take the kids, get right to you if you want to. Nah, bro, we'll keep them there. This should be a good warning for her. So, you know, I don't think a lot of men really understand that presence. It doesn't have to be a physical presence. It could be that your kids – here's what I always did with my kids when they were very young. I always left them with a good experience. So if I never saw them again, they would have a good memory of me. And so when we do talk, they always talk about, remember the time we did this, or remember the time you said this, or remember the time you did it? And that was on purpose to do that. So even if you're a non-custodial father, you still have an impact and influence on your children. because the memories you give them, the things that you say, they hold on to dearly when you're not around them physically. But when you're there, just be there. Be there, be present, and all that other stuff. But I always had eyes on them, whether they knew it or not. And when she said it, you could see her eyes water. And like, what? I said, remember you were at the store and such and such and such? She said, you weren't there. I said, I know. Said, your mama didn't have to invite me on certain stuff. I made it a point to make sure I kept eyes on you, and I stayed in Chicago to make sure if anything happened to you, that I would be there to make sure you're okay. Because I thought about moving a long time ago, but I said, you know what? I'm going to stay here until they become adults, and then I'll make my plans to move elsewhere. But I'm still here. But that was a conscious decision I made because I had a lot of job offers all over the country. But I'm like, no, I can't leave because my son and daughter is here, and I want to be in close proximity to them in case something happens. And that was a conscious decision. That wasn't a decision of being selfish, like, you know, I ain't in the house, I ain't around them, bump them, I'm going over here, be with whoever, such and such and such, and do my thing and do me. Nah, I had to, when you become an adult man, you have to make decisions not only for yourself, but for your offspring. And so a lot of brothers have never been taught that. And I know I was taught that. And so I had to really kind of prove and do that to make sure that I'm making the best decisions for them, and that whatever decision I make is going to affect them some kind of way. So I got to be careful in the decisions I make.
Mr. Charles, we speak of some of this. There's a factor, and there's many factors. No, not one factor is going to clean this up, but there's some factors. But one of the key factors, I believe, is that the father, man, especially when it comes to male, man. You look at the young male, and sometimes when a father's not around, a young male don't even know who he is, bro. He doesn't have how does he have identity? Because a male looks at the father to basically understand his role as a man. So when that father basically chooses to not be there, not tend to be what he needs to be, I remember real quick, I'm going to just say this. I was a chaperone on a trip with my son, seventh, eighth grade. And we were going to New York. We were going to a museum, another spot. And the music teacher asked me to chaperone. What I think might have been one of the only males to come on the trip. So as we boarded the bus, the teachers were up in front. And the social studies teacher said, yeah, you can sit in the back there with the kids. So I got the job of basically keeping the kids in order in the back, and they're front. So I'm sitting back there, and things are, for the most part, really good, real good. But there was one young male that was talking, and he was saying how his father has been in and out of jail part of his life, and he's going to his father and asking him for the truth. He said, my father won't tell me what happened. He said, I know my father's been in jail. Why don't my father just tell me the truth? And I'm watching other kids console him and talk to him. And I'm like, damn. And here's a kid just reaching out for information. He just wants the truth. And again, young men mirror their dad. They learn from their fathers. Non-communication, just that you're there, you're doing certain things. Where you handle certain situations. So to me, some of this comes out in the role of a father being absent or not being a father you should be some of these males. Your reaction to that, Mr. Jones?
Now, I agree with that 100% in regards to the importance of the father, because there's nobody like your father. But I do go back to what DeMaurice mentioned about not being taught how to be a father. That's not an excuse, and nor is it an excuse for a man not to take care of his children because he's mad at their mother. You know, that's a relationship that you have with your children no matter what. And I do agree, and I love what Ms. DeMaurice said, that it's important to have other people from your family or other people that you know that are real men connected with your kids and your family, people that you can trust. Not saying you have to go to everybody, but there are certain ones. I know, like with my brother and his children, my nephew, I've been around him since he was like a toddler. And as he started to grow as a little boy, I was around him. And now we seem to have the opportunity to be around him even more as he becomes, as he's a teenager going into young adulthood. And the conversations that we have now are so intense because he wants to know things that even his dad doesn't feel comfortable sharing with him. But he can talk to me about it because I'm your uncle. I want to tell you certain things. Your parents have a certain role. Father might feel some kind of way. You may not be able to share with him this, but he can talk to me about it. But the whole point of it is, and that's why I even try to, even if I'm not connected with a young man or I'm not his dad, if there's an opportunity, even a small smidgen of, or an opportunity for me to speak positive life into him, positive reinforcement, engage with him, compliment him, let him know from once he came the wonderful history that he has as a man of color. I had that opportunity. I delivered that into him. Now, he might be getting some more negatives around somewhere else, but I tried to deliver that in him because you never know that one or two times or 5, 10, 15, whatever it may be, it might be something that can spark positivity in a young person. Because if you never had that from your dad, yeah, dads have all the responsibility in the world. But if they're not there, then I can't come back and go, well, yeah, they should be, but nah, I'm not feeling that. Because I know too many people that didn't have the fathers in their lives, and they needed strong influences in their lives. My dad was a perfect example. There was not a kid he didn't love. Anytime he ran to them, they gravitated to my father to the point where I was supposed to be joining the Cub Scouts. My dad served as as one of the leaders, troop leaders or whatever it is. And hell, he had more adopted kids. I never got a chance to spend time with him. And at first I looked at it like, damn. Damn, this is going to be a father-son thing, right, Daddy? Man, them kids were gravitating to him like, man, like he was their dad. All of them, the ones that particularly didn't have a father in their life, they loved my father. So after 2 weeks, I told my dad, nah, I'm not doing this no more. He said, what you talking about? I said, nah. I said, that's your group. He said, are you mad? Are you jealous? I said, no, sir. But I thought we were going to do it together. So you go ahead and do. They need you. I ain't mad at you. That's your time. You do your. I don't want to sit around here watching them, whatever. I'm going to do something else. He said, all right, are you sure? I said, yeah, I'm not mad, Daddy. I'm sure. I promise you. But they need you. I can tell. I mean, them kids, man, they was all, as soon as they seen, they run up to him and see him again, then they hug him and he talked to him. And he had a way with children and people. And they loved my father. I mean, even they didn't know him, but they loved him for even the short time that they got to spend around him. So, yeah, it takes all of us, man. I know we can't all do it because it's not enough. Not enough of us going to take the time to do it. But we have to remove that whole point of, okay, yeah, the dad's not around, so we can always go after the father as to why they should be doing it. But there's too many other young men out here like us that are hurting and don't receive the attention they need. Like you mentioned about that whole education promise situation. If nobody speaks positivity in you, like I said, and I've been for my dad, I've probably been at working part-time somewhere. I know I've been selling dope because it was too easy. I knew a kingpin. He made quick money. See, that was easy. Tim Grady had a deuce and a quarter rolling like that with Gangsta White Walls. That William Devane, that was my boy, Tim Grady. I was like, shit, I want one of those. You know what I'm saying? I said, I can get that in 6 months, let alone 2 months, because that's how it was rolling. So knowing that, we have to continue to push forward and speak positivity into our young men, no matter regardless if the dad's not in the life. And a lot of women, as I get off of this, a lot of women will say, well, oh, no, what are you talking to my son like that? No, your son needs that. That's the problem. You so mad. You so mad at that man or these men out here that nobody stepped up to you that you want to stop your son from receiving a blessing from a strong black man?
I love what we do, gentlemen. I love what we do. It's from Black Men Talk, Mr. DeReese, Mr. Charles, and by the way, Mr. Charles is celebrating a birthday today. Happy birthday once again. Gentlemen, let's take a little break. We come back. We can do some questions. I believe we did justice on the black man. One Black Man Talk. Piggyback on something you said there, Mr. Charles, and in my own fashion, is that, you know, women and men, we have to start to see value in young black males, even if they're not our own. You know, we have to see value in them and basically water the value that we see and let it blossom. And don't treat them like they're something less than what they are. And that's part of the solution. That's part of it. You know, we have to start to mother kids and father kids that's not our own, that we see out in the neighborhood, we see out in the community. Let them know they're, you know, they're worthy. They're deserving of love. If they're not getting it, it's our responsibility to let them know. Mr. DeReese, your first question for us this episode, sir.
Well, I was going to ask the Big Al question, but I'm going to say that for another time. Salute to Big Al, by the way. But
next week we won't go into the Big Al story in theory, my brother. We'll go into that one.
Yeah. That's, stay tuned for that one. That's a special. But I was watching. We were all watching the draft, man. I've been watching it for the last, you know, the 3 days of the draft, and it was a happy time to see those young men realize their goals. But at the same time, I started thinking afterwards, man. I'm really scared for these guys because they're going into an industry that, you know, values them now at the potential of what they can give these teams and give the league, but can be used and abused and kind of thrown away like a damaged soda can or a finished soda can after their career is over. My question is, with all that they have to kind of face and the pressure and all that stuff, put yourself in their position. Would you be able to handle the weight, and how would you be able to handle the weight of all that pressure, that temptation that comes with a professional athlete, or let's break it down, an NFL football player?
I think that there has to be a mentor, and I think this is where players that may have played a while ago, even for a certain team, let's say the cat that went to San Fran, Trey Lance, I think his name is, I'm going to pull them off the hat. And even, the cat that came to Chicago from Ohio State, there must be, Justin Fields, there must be some older football players from those teams, those organizations. They must come in and keep these guys on a level playing field mentally as much as they can. And at the same time, make them aware that you want to get in this game, get what you can, and kind of get out. Don't let the game get you. Meaning, you know, make your money. Come in with a game plan. Make your money, try to cheat, and leave. Don't come out of the game if you can, broken down mentally and physically. And I think you're starting to see more players now. You know, I think over the past couple of years, you've seen players kind of walk away that you see they can still play a little longer. And I even look at Aaron Rodgers, in a sense, who's basically telling his team, I don't have to be here anymore. I really don't. And understand your, at all times, man, understand your value and your worth. And look at it as, okay, I'm going to get this and I'm going to move on, as opposed to basically thinking this is the end all. And I think that's where the older players and the mentors can come in and help them out. And I think that's what they need, really. I mean, when things kind of settle down, once this, you know, hurrah, the drafts kind of settle down, they need to have those players from that played before that can come and speak to them. You know, not only just, you know, once, but kind of always kind of show up and be there. And I think here again, talk about black men. A lot of these players got drafted on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. They're young black men. So that's where the older black man can come in and say, you know what, I've been this, what I've done, you know, some mistakes I've made, some mistakes I've seen. You may want to try it this way. Your response, Mr. Charles.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there should be some mentors available, or there's a lot of, you'd be surprised the number of NFL former players that are around. They may not be the stars that you knew or in the Hall of Fame, but there are a lot of them around that had various experiences, and they can tell you what to look, tell these young men to look out for. But I think, like you said, a lot of it comes as to the rearing as a, as that you had as a kid and what you know about money. That's the other thing, too. Mm. The way I grew up, I didn't have anything. We weren't like, there were moments where it was really tough. But yeah, I look at it this way, and I was taught this way. If I come in and I can live about $20 a week of food with combination of bread, sandwiches, bologna sandwiches, whatever, ham sandwiches, peanut butter and jelly, a lot of crap, Doritos, popcorn, little fruit here and there, and juices and soda, and I can make I can get that out of and ramen noodles, $20 a week, and then you're going to increase that to thousands of dollars? Shit, I'm going to be rich. I'm going to be rich because I'm not going to spend all my damn money. Just in case. I don't want to go back to where I was. So if I can live off $20, imagine what I can do with all that money. Everybody's not equipped like that, but I'm banking my money. I'm going to buy some things now, but I'm going to bank my money because, hell, I'm going to sit back and go, shit, I lived out $20. Now you're going to give me how much I'm making a week? I'm making 10 grand a week? Are you crazy as hell? I'm about to be rich. I'm going to be rich. You ain't got to tell me. But the other part is must teach them mentors, other people that have been through it, to say, look, the people that get you your money, your agent, is not the same. The person that gets your money is not the same person that should be spending your money. That's where a lot of them fall short. Real talk.
Hmm. Yeah. I agree with that 100%. But I've noticed a lot of players in sports, football and basketball, you see the names popping up now. They're not spending their cash at all. I mean, look at Marshawn Lynch. Look at Kawhi Leonard. The names go on and on where these cats, man, are basically living. I think I saw the truck that Leonard was driving a few years ago. Bro, I mean, that's always beat down. I said beat down. I'm talking beat down. And you say to yourself initially when you see it, why don't he buy something? Why? It's taking where he has to go. So I think so many players now coming in, they're smarter than maybe years ago, but they're realizing, yeah, this money faucet is not going to run always. So get what you can and do proper with it. Your response to your question, Mr. Rims?
Yeah, man, you're talking about a 21, 22, maybe 23-year-old kid, man. And think about when we were 21, 22, 23, and we got some money and how we kind of flossed and bought things that we wanted and we wanted to look a certain way, do a certain way. It'll be really hard. I feel for these guys, man, because a lot of temptation, the women, the people you don't know if you can trust anymore. Hopefully they're getting the mentors and all that. But I thought about myself as like, man, because sometimes, and this is the way I am sometimes, not all the time, and I had to get real good about this. If I have $500 and I'm going out, I'm going to spend $500. So I can't imagine being a 21-year-old. You give me that amount of money? Like, okay, tomorrow's tomorrow, but tonight? This is what's going on. So I feel for them. I really feel for them, and I hope they're getting the guidance, and I hope that they're wise enough or have the background and the family support to say, because a lot of these guys are going to get vultures from their own family. Now, I got this, you know, family members like, I got this business plan, and all I need is this amount of money. And then all of a sudden, they're on the show 30 for 30 broke. You know, when you saw that documentary. But I hope they have somebody that can really help them. I remember Herb Edwards, when I guess they go to seminars, the rookies, they go to seminars, and Herb Edwards was saying, you only need one car, you only need one house, you only need one gold chain to play. You don't need 2-3 houses and buy it, your mama this and all that. I know you want to be good to mama, but that money goes away quick. And Also, these players don't realize that every game that you play in different cities, when you get paid, you have to pay taxes on those away games. So I hope somebody's explaining the money. And every person's kind of work, the working years is like 45 years of working years. And so you're making a lot of money in a shorter period of time. How do you make that work for 45 years so that you can be comfortable once you not only retire from football, but retire when you get to your 60s? Because me and Mark have a cousin who was trying to retire, and that's a whole nother story for a whole nother show. But that's all I got. That's all I got.
Oh, man. That right there, woo. That's a whole segment right there. Mr. Charles, your question.
Yeah, my question is, with all of the stuff that's been going on with Black Lives Matter, it seems like some of the – you mentioned about the what the NFL was doing in regards to, like, trying to bring some history knowledge back to by African Americans. You saw what's going on with baseball. They've talked about the Negro Leagues. Yes, when I was watching the Kentucky Derby, they had someone working with NBC Sports was kind of unusual. They had African-American four-time gold medalist, Sanya Richards Ross, who's a beautiful lady, serving as a consultant for fashion and lifestyle. And she was looking at the hats and whatnot that the ladies were wearing. And she had a beautiful ensemble on. So my question is, do you think with this movement that we're seeing right now, is just something that is happening because of the Black Lives Movement, Lives Matter movement, with all of them pressing some of the people of color to the forefront, or do you think it's something that's going to fall off in a short period of time?
I'm going to be optimistic and say it's not going to fall off, man. And I'm going to step out and say it. I don't think it really is. I'm going to say this, and I've been feeling this for a while, and I know you speak of Kaepernick, and what Black Lives Matter has done prior to George Floyd. And I said this about COVID, how, in a sense, how COVID was a correction for us. You know, God put COVID together to basically give us a chance to kind of sit back, look at ourselves, and correct some things. Just my feeling and my thought, man. George Floyd was a sacrifice, bro. And because everything that was going around America, the world, did not want to listen and want to hear. No matter how the situation went down, we saw for what it was, they were turning a blind eye, kind of like a blind ear. But when those minutes ticked and ticked and ticked and ticked, and you're watching that video, it resonated with the world. It just did. And I'm not saying it had to happen that way, but something inside of me said that it had to be something to wake up the world and the country. I was riding by a church today, and I've seen the sign before. I was riding by this white Lutheran church today, big church here in the city. And you pull up to it, and beautiful church, beautiful lawn, beautiful Black Life Matter song, Life Matter sign is right there. You ride to some neighborhoods where it's predominantly white. You look on their lawn. Black Lives Matter, still there. So I think it has waking up the conscience. I'm not going to say you're not going to have some people out there that's not with it. You're never going to have unity 100% anything that happens. But I don't think it's going to fall off because I think people understand now. And I think sometimes we take for granted that everyone that's a different shade than us is just bad. And that's not true. You know, God lives in everyone, no matter what color you are. Some people are here to it, and some people don't. But I think now more people are here to it in that sense of God than in the past. And for that reason, I don't think it's falling off. Your response, Mr. DeMarais?
I hope not, and because I think what it's going to depend on is the players in the league to keep this going. Not only us on the outside in society and folks that are out there marching and working for the effort, but the players to keep this
keep this premier up to the NFL because they represent the league over 75% to 85%. And then in NBA also, and then other sports are following suit. So I think as long as the players, society keeps it up, and the players, I think more importantly, putting this in the minds of the owners, the coaches, the organizations they represent, I hope it has some staying power. I hope it lives a long and healthy life in the minds of not only these organizations, but the fans start to see it. Players start to really kind of use their voice and use their platform in a much more productive way. I hope it sustains itself. And it's going to take a long time to correct all the ills. But this is a good start. I know there's still feet on the ground working in these efforts. I was out today doing some protesting from a Asian group that in Myanmar, which is, people sometimes know as Burma, and being asked to facilitate some trainings and things of those so they can get together and work on their behalf. Imagine that, a black guy working with Asian groups. And so I met some of the folks in this group who came out and supported Black Lives Matters when I was out there doing that. So I think it's resonating in a lot of different segments of society that we didn't expect it to resonate. And I hope the momentum keeps going on. I hope it doesn't slow up. I hope people don't forget. But when we talk about the NFL, I think it's on the players to keep this thing going.
Yeah, corporate America, we forget about them. They are basically on the bandwagon as well. And that's huge. And that's to not be looked upon as being small to where they're on it. And, I think it's headed in the right direction. I don't think it's going to fall off. Your response, Mr. Jones?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope it continues to move forward because it's opening the eyes of a lot of people. And there are a lot of talented individuals, and there anything that can bring more people together and have people received in the mainstream goes a long way. And just for the record, she was beautiful, man. She was absolutely stunning, and she knew exactly what she was doing. And it just kind of showed that perhaps we need more opportunities that way. But then just in general, as you said, Dee Maurice, going out there and people coming together with the whole point of George Floyd. Like I said, you can say what you want to, but as Mark, you mentioned, that was a game changer. That was life changing for a lot of people. Literally, while you watched a man after so many minutes with his being down like that, go from being alive to dying right before your eyes. That was moving.
Yeah, there's some things that happen, man. I just think that sometimes we can't put it in a proper perspective. We see it and we just can't. And sometimes it takes a while to fall into where it needs to be. But that's how that resonated with me for a while. And I was, reluctant to say it because you never want to a man lost his life and kind of put it in a fashion to where it may not be looked upon the right way. But I've always kind of seen it that way. And there's things that happen, man, that, we just have to kind of see it. Sometimes, for me, see it for what it's worth. See it for what it is. Mr. Demetri, you have another question, sir?
I didn't think I didn't prepare another question, so I'm gonna give my time
That's
up
okay.
to either one of you.
Mr. Charles, if you got something, sir.
Yeah. So my question is, when you were a young man, and this is connected still to the African American man. What was it in your lifetime, or what was it as a young man as you were growing up that started to develop the type of woman, and not so much physically, but the type of woman that you thought you wanted to connect with? Was it an example? Was it somebody that you met, somebody that you knew, or somebody you ran into that made you go, wow, when I grow up or whatever, that's the type of woman that I would like to have in my life. It doesn't have to be a specific person, but just in general. And Frank,
I think sometimes in high school, man, I saw You can tell then if you saw a woman or a young girl, and she's just about it. You know, she's kind of just about what she was doing, her schoolwork, the way she carried herself. And that was key, the way she carried herself. You know, where she kind of, not like put herself above other people, but the way she kind of held herself, she, in essence, did put herself above other people. And it kind of made you want to see more and understand more about her. And you kind of believe that she was going to go on to do, you know, extraordinary things. So to me, from that looking, you always wanted, for me, I always wanted to kind of be around someone that was just not handle it. They carried himself in a certain way, sophistication, a woman, just plain a woman. And, you know, there's certain things back then that women just didn't do, and especially when people are watching. So that classiness, you know, always kind of resonated, and it started early, and it's still present to this day. Your response, Mr. Lewis.
Okay, I mentioned Ms. Carberry earlier, my English teacher in senior year of high school, and we went out to dinner, and I knew sitting across from her that night that I got to step my game up if I want to, because we went to a posh restaurant. I mean, she said, get dressed in your best. I'm taking you out to dinner. I'm thinking, you know, we're going to Red Lobster. Nah, we went to this posh. It was a restaurant called September's in New Haven, in outskirts of New Haven. And we went to that restaurant, and I'm sitting at this table with this grown woman. I'm a senior in high school, 17 years old. I'm like, I got to step my game up if I want to date and marry somebody like this, because I like the attention I'm getting, because everybody had their eyes on, what is this young guy doing with this grown woman? Sophisticated, educated, beautiful. I'm like, yes, this is what I want. So if I got to go to college to get this, I'm going.
Motivation.
That's motivation, boy.
2 minutes. That's it right there, man. You come from anywhere. 2 minutes before we get out of here, Mr. Charles, your response, sir.
Yeah, real quick. Mine started in the third grade, Miss Thomas. Miss Thomas, boy, she was the true essence of femininity. She always wore dresses. She smelled great. Her hair was pristine, and she was just so nice. When she come along, she just, like, touch her shoulder. You like, oh, my God, I need to bring her an apple. I was like, that's a lady. In the third grade, I was like, I want one of those. She was professional. I said, I don't know how, but damn it, I'm going to have to read these books. I'm going to have to learn something, because she was the essence of femininity. I love femininity to this day because Miss Thomas. Thank you, Miss Thomas.
You know, it's funny because as much in the current day world where women are dressing and showing everything and shaking and jiving, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying we're not attracted to that, but at the end of the day, a man really wants a woman, just a feminine, classy, sophisticated woman. That wins all the time, bro. You know, that'll catch your attention all the time, and it'll stop your tracks. So, you know, women need to think about that, you know, with the long fake hair, fake eyelashes, all that other stuff. I'm here to tell you, that ain't being a woman. It's not. Just be you. Present yourself as you are, you know, and let any good man notice you and come to you, because it doesn't take all that. You don't need hair down to your ass. You don't need it. You just don't. You don't have to color all different ways. Just be you, and your stuff should be enough. Gentlemen, we get together next week. It's When Black Men Talk. Mr. Charles, Mr. DeReese, thank you for giving us a thank you.